Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's June 2nd. 56 degrees under some partly cloudy skies. 60 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. It's time for your Monday forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at partly cloudy skies as we move throughout the day. There is a chance of a couple of isolated showers as we go throughout the first half of your day. Otherwise, temperatures climbing into the lower 70s in Park City. Highs will be into the upper 70s in the Heber Valley, so much cooler than where we saw as we went throughout our weekend. Now, as we go into your Tuesday, look for that sunshine to return, along with some slightly cooler temperatures sticking around. High temperatures on your Tuesday, only in the mid-60s there for us in Park City, with high temperatures only into the low to mid-70s for the Heber Valley. So, yeah, we're talking about temperatures a little below average as we get towards your Tuesday. As we go on to your Wednesday, temperatures remain on the cool side. Highs only in the upper 60s in Park City with sunshine, and highs will be into the mid-70s across the Heber Valley with plenty of sunshine. We start to see more changes arriving, though, as we get towards your Thursday into Friday. Another weak storm system will try to move by, mainly to our south, but it'll bring us a few more clouds as we go into your Thursday. Highs will be in the low 70s in Park City with highs into the mid 70s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Friday, a slightly better chance Thursday night into Friday of a few scattered showers with that weak system as it moves through. Partly cloudy skies otherwise, with high temperatures in Park City in the low 70s. Highs will be into the mid to upper 70s for the Heber Valley. As we move into the weekend, look for that sunshine to return, and as we get that sunshine, we dry things out and we'll heat things back up once again. We're talking high temperatures back into the mid to upper 70s there in Park City, and we're looking at high temperatures into the low to mid 80s for the Heber Valley with partly cloudy skies. We'll see more sunshine showing up as we head towards the second half of the weekend as well. So even though we're going to start off things with some seasonably cool temperatures for the first half of the week, get ready for another warming trend just in time for the weekend as we start to dry things back out and bring back the sunshine. From the ABC Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Okay, according to Summit County Public Information Officer Skylar Talbot, we've got the Utah Highway Patrol involved in a pursuit, which is why we're seeing some of the backup on I-80 eastbound there between US 40 and Promontory exit there, the Tollgate Canyon exit. Looks like the right lane and the right shoulder are being blocked off with just cars being allowed to go through on the fast lane there. So once we get more information, we'll be sure to pass that along. But again, at this point, we just know of a traffic backup there between US 40 and Tollgate Canyon. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the CEO of IHC Park City Hospital, Lori Weston, be talking about their new expansion plans. Heber City Manager Matt Brower previewing tomorrow's City Council meeting, and Leadership Park City Class 31 members Susan O'Dell, Pete Deininger, and Caitlin Hoffman recap this year's city tour. Well, residents have until Friday, June 6th, to run to file in the 2025 municipal election. Candidates who are interested must have lived in a town for 12 consecutive months and be a registered voter. Park City, Camas, Oakley, Colville, and Francis all have two open at-large council seats to fill. Hennifer has three. All six Summit County towns will elect mayors this year. The filing period for municipal candidates again opens today and will run through Friday, 5 p.m. Summit County will fill board seats in three water and fire special districts. The filing period for special district candidates is extended until Monday, June 9th. In Wasatch County, all towns except Wallsburg have mayoral elections in November. Heber City, Midway, Hideout, and Charleston each have two open city council seats, while Daniel and Wallsburg will vote in three council members. If needed, primaries will be held August 12th, followed by 2025 municipal elections scheduled for November 4th. Well, a law professor says NPR's lawsuit against the Trump administration goes to the heart of the law that established public media in the United States. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that NPR is trying to maintain taxpayer funding.
President Donald Trump handed down an executive order May 1st prohibiting National Public Radio and Television's Public Broadcasting Service from receiving any money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which allocates money to NPR member stations like KPCW. NPR and three Colorado member stations sued May 27th, and University of Virginia law professor Scott Ballinger broke it down on KPCW's Local News Hour Friday.
NPR has the usual argument that's been made against a lot of Trump administration initiatives lately, that they just don't have authority to decree all of these things by executive fiat. If they want to fundamentally change how the Corporation for Public Broadcasting works, they should go through Congress and pass legislation. But here that argument is even sharper than usual, because the statutes Congress passed actually seem to directly forbid political interference with the corporation.
That is, the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, which set up CPB, does not allow, quote, any department, agency, officer, or employee of the U.S. to exercise any direction, supervision, or control over public telecommunications or over the corporation or public telecommunications entity. The Trump administration hadn't responded to the lawsuit as of May 30th, but Ballinger thinks it'll argue that that part of the Public Broadcasting Act is unconstitutional.
The court recently ruled in a case called Trump versus Wilcox that the president can fire members of the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board, despite statutes saying very clearly otherwise. And this is a sort of unitary executive argument that, you know, the president really has to be in charge of the executive branch.
On the other hand, most courts have preserved the independence of the nation's central bank, for example, since the election.
Who knows what that means for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? But the point is that this dispute over the statutory independence of the corporation is just one front in a much larger war about independent agencies more broadly.
Ballinger broke down NPR's First Amendment claims for KPCW, too. That full interview is at kpcw.org. He expects the lawsuit to move slowly. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Intermountain Park City Hospital has some big plans. In the studio with details, I have the CEO of the Park City Hospital, Lori Weston. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so the news is that you'll be having a groundbreaking celebration later this month for the surgery and emergency services expansion, as well as a new cancer center. So tell us what's being planned.
Yes, we've got, as you said, emergency room and surgery will be expanding this year, along with an innovative cancer center here on the Wasatch Back.
Yeah, so how much are we adding on to, like, the surgery?
The cancer center on the back of the hospital will add, it'll be 10,000 square feet total. It's about 5,000 additional to what's on the building. And then the ER and surgery will add 16,000 square feet on the back side of the hospital.
Okay, so is that it then for the hospital expansion? Can you get any bigger?
We can get a little bit bigger, but we're almost at our full density on that campus, yes.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit. I mean, you're adding how many, what, surgical suites? Is that what you're looking at?
Yes, we're adding two surgery suites. We're also going to shell two, and then we will be adding two endoscopy suites as well. Our imaging services will be expanded. We'll have PET CT. We have a mobile right now, so we'll be bringing that in-house. Our laboratory will be expanded as well. And then our cancer center will be expanded to include a linear accelerator to do radiation therapy.
Okay, and so you do have a cancer center now, huh?
So right now we are doing infusion and chemo at both of our hospitals on the Wasatch Back, Heber and Park City. We also have medical oncologists that see patients. Both hospitals will be doing inpatient appointments starting this month for medical oncology, and radiation oncology will come when the cancer center is open.
All right. So I read that you're going to be able to treat up to 90% of all cancer cases in the Wasatch Back. What is it that you cannot treat?
It'll be those more highly complex cases. We won't be able to do all of the surgeries at Park City and Heber hospitals, so those will be closely coordinated with Intermountain Medical Center and LDS hospitals.
All right. So what's something like this going to cost?
We are looking around over $40 million is the investment that Intermountain is making in these two hospitals right now to bring cancer and trauma services to the Wasatch Back.
And do you have that money raised?
We have some of it raised. Intermountain has backed the equipment and capital of this project and is looking to raise funds to continue operations, support cancer survivorship, and some of those other programs that are needed to bring these services to the hospital.
Explain what cancer survivorship.
Cancer survivorship. So we'll be able to treat from diagnosis to cancer survivorship. So people that are, once they're completed with their cancer treatments and are on the path to recovery, our LiveWell Center will house cancer survivorship services. We currently offer those right now. That will include massage, acupuncture. Our dietitians are oncology trained, and also rehab services for balance and motion, getting people back to where they were prior to their cancer journey.
And you would think we're just too small, but it sounds like we've got a number of cases and that it's needed.
We do. Intermountain cares for over 16,000 people every year. 8,000 of those are in Utah hospitals. Over 500 cases from the Wasatch Back and beyond will be treated up here on the Wasatch Back with this addition.
Okay. So what's the timeline on all of this?
So we will be breaking ground towards the end of June and hoping the Cancer Center will be open second quarter of 2026. Our ER and surgery services will probably be the end of 26, first part of 27, depending on construction timelines and what the weather does to us this year.
And when I mentioned, $40 million, some of that is raised. What do? You go out and bond that, or are you looking for... a lot of centers, right, would have naming rights to it?
Yes, naming rights, equipment, a lot of it we'll do an endowment to keep operations running. There's things like navigation and, the survivorship services that are needed to support this program.
Okay. People, again, are welcome to turn out for the groundbreaking ceremony. Again, that's Thursday, June 12th, 9:30 to 10:30, and you'll have signs out there. People can just kind of follow along.
Yes, it'll be on the backside of the hospital, so I hope everybody can come join us.
Yeah, so as you expand, do you have the staff to fill
this? We are currently recruiting. We have recruited for cancer. We've got two medical oncologists that are rotating up from the Valley to get us started. We do have an oncologist that we are under contract right now, medical oncologist, and then we will have nursing staff and financial navigators and social workers as well.
Mm-hmm. And do you see a lot of them that do just make the commute, or?
We do. We have some that will commute, hoping that we'll have some that are local in the area as well.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about that?
No, we're just excited to bring it and bring this to the community, keep care close to home. Cancer, as you know, it impacts everyone in our lives, and we want to make sure they have access to care.
Okay. Lori, I appreciate your time this morning. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's Lori Weston, the CEO of the IHC Park City Hospital. Well, a sunny Sunday with temperatures in the 80s was a welcome start to the Park City Sunday's 19th season. Until the Silly Market first opened in 2006, Sundays in Park City's Main Street pretty quiet. Today, the lower half of Main Street bustling with artists, shoppers, and those just looking. Live music plays in the background of the street churn. Silly Market Executive Director Kate McChesney says the market today boasts almost 200 vendors compared to the 35 it first started with in the early days. Some 500 people would come out each Sunday. Today, the crowds have grown to about 16,000 every week. The first of 11 markets for 2025 opened yesterday morning. In addition to the vendors selling their wares, the market employs face painters and balloon artists and staffs an area just for kids. The Free Bike Valet is back this year, as well as food vendors and the beer garden. One of the longest tenured artists on the street is leather worker Kathy Pedersen of Boomdog Creations. She's been selling her one-of-a-kind dog collars on Main Street for 15 years. Originally from Las Vegas, Pedersen spent her first winter in Park City in 2009 after her husband fell ill and had to spend months at a Salt Lake area hospital. It was then that she began her second career making leather dog collars.
I was bored because I had to stay here in the winter. So I opened up one of my drawers and there were my old Western belts. And I said, my labs were in there. And I said, this will make an amazing dog collar. That's what started it.
The business has expanded to include dog harnesses, dog bowls, and wrist cuffs using repurposed hand-tooled leather. Vintage rhinestone jewelry and authentic silver conchos are incorporated into her designs, ensuring no two pieces are exactly alike. Alexis Bernard is the owner and baker at Your Local Bread Bee. This is her first year at the Silly Market. She began making sourdough to keep busy while her athlete husband was on the road.
My husband is a professional football player, so he would leave for a few months. And so I just did a hobby every single day that made me happy. And one of those hobbies was making sourdough starter. It took a few weeks to get a starter going, and I started making sourdough like lots of people, but it just took off, and now it's a business that's growing.
Bernard will be attending all 11 markets. She brought 400 loaves to her first market and expected to go home empty-handed.
We will see. Normally, we sell out, but I have not done Park Silly Market before. I heard it's a beast, and so I wanted to show up and try to bring as many loaves as I could.
In addition to the sourdough, she baked cinnamon raisin, rosemary garlic, and jalapeno cheddar loaves. Kathleen Royster is a ceramicist who uses porcelain clay to create a modern version of an ancient Korean technique. She's been selling her work in Park City for the last 12 seasons.
Ceramics has a long history of blue and white ware, and I use an old Korean technique called mishma, and it's an inlaid colored clay. So I draw the lines with an X-Acto knife, paint over it with a blue slip, and it gets down in the cuts, and then I wipe it clean. So I just contemporized a 1,000-year-old technique.
Royster is a helper resident and has a gallery on Helper's Main Street. She says she's done great business during the Helper's Saturday Vibes Market. That's another open-air market that was started there 5 years ago by the founder of the Silly Market, Kimberly Kuhn. This year's Park Silly Market will be open every Sunday in June with two markets in July. It then takes a break until August 31st, returning for three more markets in September with the final market taking place September 21st. The HBO original film Mountainhead, which was shot at a Deercrest mansion earlier this year, is being released to streaming. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has details from the film's producer.
Succession showrunner Jesse Armstrong is making his directorial debut with Mountainhead, starring Steve Carell, Jason Schwartzman, Corey Michael Smith, and Rami Youssef as billionaires. HBO Executive Vice President of Production Janet Graham-Borba describes the plot, which is set over one weekend at a mountain mansion in the Deercrest neighborhood.
The guys are coming together at a time of a little bit of unrest and chaos, and they each are bringing a little bit of a personal struggle to the weekend and a lot of history between the four men. If you watched Succession, you'll have a sense of the flavor of Jesse Armstrong's approach to wit, intelligence, power, social consequence, but also just personal relationships.
Borba said the film was produced in an unprecedented timeline. She said Armstrong pitched the film to HBO in December 2024, wrote the screenplay in January, and shot the movie in March.
This has not been done, not by us and not at this level by anyone that I'm aware of. You can do lots of sort of little indie movies where you're going to shoot for 5 days. You can do those quickly. But, you know, a show written by someone of that prominence with that level of artistic care, with that caliber of cast, and the what I think you will be impressed by in terms of production value and storytelling, not this quickly.
The film is primarily set at the 21,000-square-foot home in Deercrest, right across the Wasatch County line. The home was listed for $65 million last year, a record single-family home price in Utah, and includes a private gondola to the slopes of Bald Eagle Mountain at Deer Valley Resort. Mountainhead premieres on cable on HBO and the company's streaming platform HBO Max at 6 p.m. Mountain Time Saturday, May 31st. Park City Film will screen Mountainhead for free June 5th at the Jim Santee Auditorium at the Park City Library. There will be a discussion afterward with production supervisor Brooke Redman and Utah Film Commission production manager Derek Mellis. A link to tickets can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, the Heber City Council meets Tuesday afternoon in work session starting at 4 o'clock. And on the phone with me with a preview of the meeting is City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
So let's start with the fact that this week is Unity Week in Heber Valley. What's going around town there?
Yes, this is Heber's Unity Week. We have a number of events that we hope will unite the community, including several concerts at our main park. One tonight at 6 o'clock. And we also have the Heber Market on Main, which is Thursday. We also have our traditional community cleanup, which starts this morning. The city has placed dumpsters strategically at all the city's parks, and that is available for our community at no cost from today through next Sunday. So all these events are intended to unite and bring the community together as we realize that we're stronger together.
All right, people can find kind of a schedule online then?
Yes.
All right, and as we've been reporting, it's time for candidates to file for office between now and Friday at 5 p.m. Two council seats and the mayor up for election in Heber City. What's the city looking for in its leaders this year?
Well, we're hoping for solid candidates who can come in, knowledgeable, and help with the tough decisions we have to make. To reiterate, the declaration period began this morning at 8 o'clock. It runs through Friday at 5 o'clock. The primary is set for August 12th with the general election for November 4th.
Okay. And have you had anybody declare at this point?
I just stepped out of the recorder's office and none thus far.
Okay. Let's talk, what are some of the biggest challenges that these candidates could face if they're elected?
Well, one of the largest challenges the city's facing, of course, is growth. And that's not a situation unique to Heber. This is something the entire state's experiencing. And the city has, for a number of years now, been trying to wrestle with the policies necessary to guide that growth, to make sure it's the type of growth that we want. As you also know, the city is coming off one of its largest capital investments in the city's history. The new candidates will have a hand in trying to finalize many of the projects that commenced several years ago. And so those are probably two of the bigger issues they'll have their hands around.
Okay. Wanted to talk about, at your most recent meeting, council talked with the Wasatch County Housing Authority about a code change that would enable the city to collect fees in lieu of affordable housing. So what's prompted this code change?
A couple things. Most notably is the master development agreement we have with Jordanelle Ridge, which is an 8,000-acre planned community up on the North Village Bench, has a requirement to build almost 600 affordable housing units. Many of those units are going to be located on the backside of the hill, which doesn't make a lot of sense from a affordable housing perspective. It's going to cost more money to drive there. There'll be very little in terms of employment up there, very little in terms of education and transportation. So the notion is to renegotiate the affordable housing terms in that development agreement and require them to pull those housing units to the front side, and also to see if perhaps we can monetize a portion of those affordable housing requirements and use that money for other affordable housing related projects. And that's really the emphasis behind that.
Yeah, some city, I guess, how much money is the city likely to collect then through this? Certainly not enough to build it.
Well, it depends upon the of course, the monetization value. It depends upon the number of units that we monetize. And so those details are being negotiated, and hopefully we'll have an agreement come before council, probably hopefully July.
All right. Some city leaders did hint at work kind of going on behind closed doors for a future affordable housing project. Can you share any details about what that might look like?
The city has had several affordable housing project principals come before us and asked if the city would participate to see if they could, see if the city could be a cash investor in the projects to make them be realized. And so, of course, the devil's in the details of what that looks like and how much money the city would be required to place in those projects. And some of the money that we would look to place in there would come from the monetization of the affordable housing requirements in the Jordanelle Ridge Development Agreement. So it's all kind of interrelated.
All right. Now, it sounds like the Housing Authority initially had some concerns that the city's decision could hurt its work. Anything Heber's doing to ensure that the two entities continue to collaborate?
Heber has long been a supporter of the Wasatch County Affordable Housing Board, will continue to be a very strong supporter. And I wouldn't be surprised at some point in the future if some portion of this monetization value does not go to the Wasatch County Affordable Housing Board. But the city has some key goals in the downtown and believes that the monetization of some of these affordable housing projects can help the city achieve some of those goals.
All right. Taking a look now at the agenda. First up is a work session, an hour-long discussion of the Central Heber Overlay Zone. A positive recommendation was forwarded by the Planning Commission. So a brief idea of what this vision will do once it's approved?
Yeah, so at Tuesday's meeting, the Planning Commission chair and vice chair is going to provide the council with a broad overview of what the Central Heber Overlay Zone is about, what its goals are, what it's intended to achieve. That will be followed by the next council meeting, June 17th, where they dive into the details of the text amendment. But generally speaking, the Central Heber Overlay Zone is intended to provide property owners in the downtown with more flexibility with their properties. It's not a mandate, it's simply another tool and toolbox that they can have to perhaps do an accessory dwelling unit, to maybe do a flag lot, a subordinate lot, to allow for maybe some small amounts of mixed use, such as townhomes or twin homes. And so it's intended to keep, on one hand, the feel of the existing downtown, but on the other hand, it's intended to provide more housing options. And we think the best place to do that is the Central Districts, because their infrastructure is there, the water lines, sewer lines, storm drain lines, and of course their roads are there as well, which means the cost to develop this housing would be much, much less.
Now the staff report says that this overlay zone would reduce short-term rentals, which take away from long-term rentals. How so? Just by not allowing them?
Correct. It would be a prohibited use in these areas.
All right. It also claims to reduce investor purchases. How can you possibly do that?
The notion is that you'd have to occupy the residence in order to do a flag lot, in order to do, for example, a twin home. You would, as the owner, would have to occupy the other house. And we believe that would be a big deterrent for these large conglomerates who are coming in and buying large numbers of homes for investment purposes. By having a occupancy and an ownership requirement would reduce, we believe, that risk.
Great. All right. No decision is expected Tuesday. So do you expect the vote, the council to vote on this June 17th or even later on?
No, we suspect it'll probably be in their first or second meeting in July. As I mentioned, tomorrow night's meeting is really focused on what an overlay zone is, what its goals are. The June 17th meeting will be focused on the actual text details and probably public input, with a decision probably made in July.
All right. On Tuesday, the council has a public hearing about your fiscal year 2026 budget. Any big changes since the council last reviewed the budget?
No substantive changes since the last council budget workshop. Tuesday's public hearing is required by the state before the city council can actually adopt it. And so this is one of the important steps that we have to take before we actually adopt that budget.
All right. Well, let's hit the highlights. How much is the budget for?
The budget is for approximately $80 million. Most of that, of course, is with the capital projects that I mentioned earlier. The city is beginning to wind down the largest capital campaign in its history. Some of the most notable projects you've probably seen in town is the $50 million water sewer line replacement project in the east district of the town. We also have a water meter project that's winding down, the Combarium project, the main stage project. So although these projects are winding down, there is significant monies included in the fiscal year 26 budget. The general fund has no tax increases proposed. It does include two new positions. We also are proposing there is some small increases in the utility rates for all four of the city's utilities, including water, sewer, stormwater, and pressurized irrigation. Those are probably some of the highlights.
Yeah, and I was going to mention that. No tax increases, but there are fee increases. Business license,
correct,
water, stormwater, and sewer. I mean, so
correct,
it's going to feel like a tax increase at some point, yeah?
Well, it's the utility funds are a fee for service, and those service costs are going up, and we have to charge the fee in order to cover those costs. And of course, to help pay for a lot of these very large utility projects and undertaking.
Okay, and you're also planning to remove the $250,000 Heber Light and Power dividend. What does that do to the budget?
Historically, Heber Light and Power has paid Heber City, as one of the key owners of the agency or the power company, a dividend of $250,000 a year. Due to some of the challenges Heber Light and Power has had over the last couple of years, they have elected not to pay that dividend. And during our most recent budget workshop, the council asked us to remove that number from the fiscal year 26 budget, as well as the fiscal year 25 budget, which is now ending. And so that's between the 2 years, $500,000. And so we've had to come up with other ways to balance that budget. And so we utilize reserves a little bit, and we've cut some additional costs. And so we feel like we're still in great shape with the budget, despite having to do away with that dividend for both fiscal years.
All right, you mentioned two new full-time employees. Who, what are you hiring?
One would be a detective in our police department to make sure that we can stay on the increasing workload. The second is a employee in our public works department. That workload is also increasing dramatically. And so those are the two positions, one in public works and the other in our police department.
All right. And in terms of COLA or staff raises, what are you looking at?
2.8% across the board increase, which matches the cost of living index for our area.
Okay. Does that include all salaried employees?
It does. That includes all salaried employees, actually all employees other than the elected employees. Other than the electeds.
Okay. So city council seeing a raise?
No. Their salaries are fixed by code. Unless that code is amended, their salaries remain fixed.
Okay. And what about you and the attorney? Do you also get that 2.8 or is that negotiated separately?
So my contract requires the city pay the same COLA that the other employees receive. So yeah, I would be eligible for it. The city attorney is a contracted attorney, and he would not be eligible for that because of that contract.
All right. Also on the agenda, the development agreement for the views on Main, a proposed five-story condominium hotel. In past discussions, transportation has been one of the main issues. So have we figured out how traffic flow will work around the development?
Yeah, so this project is located on the south end of Highway 40, near the hub, just a little bit north of the hub. This is intended to be a five-story development, which is currently permitted in our zoning code. The development agreement, which is on the agenda for Tuesday night, is really a negotiation we went through to help the city preserve three key roads that this project would have significant influence on. The first is 100 East, which would take it from essentially 600 South down to 1200 South. The new fire station, which was dedicated a couple of weeks ago, was required to build a portion of that roadway. The views would be required to dedicate a significant portion of the right-of-way. The other two roads are east-west roads. I think it's 860 and 790, and we've been successful negotiating the exaction from the developer for the right-of-ways for these three roads.
Okay, any concern about the number of trips that these short-term rentals are going to add to Main Street?
There's always concern about traffic increasing due to projects, but it's important to note that this particular project is located on Highway 40, which is the largest road we have in the city, has the greatest capacity. And if we're successful at getting the 100 East, 790, and 860 roads, that would go a long way towards relieving any additional trip generation that would take place from this project.
Okay. The band shell in City Park, is it finished yet?
Oh, it is very close. Very, very close. In fact, we have a final walkthrough today to see if we can give it a CO or whether there are still issues to be addressed. We're hoping that we'll have our first Heber Market on Main concert in that band shell this Thursday. If not, we'll pivot and play the concert out of the old Rotary band shell, which is still there. And so keep your fingers crossed. We think we'll have some conversations this morning and hopefully get a CO.
All right. So why so many delays with this?
Although it is a fairly small project, it is a very sophisticated project in terms of its steel structure, in terms of its architecture. So we are trying to work through those issues. We're trying to work with the contractor on civil concerns that they've had about the project. And there's just been a number of challenges that we've had, and we continue to try to work through, and hopefully, keep fingers crossed, they'll be ready for our first concert here this Thursday.
Okay. The agenda also mentions a joint meeting with Wasatch County. What's going to be on that agenda, do you know?
Yeah, so that meeting is planned for June 12th at 7 p.m. The Wasatch County Council have contacted the city and asked for the joint meeting. It's my understanding the joint meeting will be dedicated to just general update about key things both organizations or both entities are doing, as well as allow the county to provide the city an update on their negotiations on the Christensen-Sitla annexation, which, as you recall, some months ago, the city consented to allowing the county to take point on it.
Right. Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Matt?
Again, just to emphasize, the 27th season of Heber Market on Main is starting this Thursday. Hope to see you there.
Okay. Matt Brow, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, a member of Leadership's Park City Class 31 returned from their annual city tour last night. In the studio with details of the tour as well as their takeaways, I have Class 31 members Susan O'Dell, Caitlin Hoffman, and Pete Dininger. Good morning to all of you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks, Leslie.
Susan, we'll start with you then. A long trip, and you traveled where?
We went to North Lake Tahoe, Truckee, and Reno. It was a long trip, and we're all recuperating, I guess.
And so you started in... The first day was North Lake Tahoe?
First day was North Lake Tahoe. And, you know, the background quickly on city tours, we take a delegation of Park City elected officials, Summit County elected officials, staff, members from tourism, representatives from transit, all, you know, all kinds of city and county people that are involved. And we try and learn from another city or county that are doing similar things to what we are. They're dealing with recreation, rapid growth, a tourism economy, and we really try and make good long-term relationships where we can rely on each other and call each other down the road to, you know, try and make our towns and cities better. And we did that. I think we had some really great meetings and we learned a lot. About 65 people from Park City and the county went, including 35, I think, of our class members. So it was a really great trip.
Yeah. Caitlin, did one of those places stand out for you? And how so?
For me, I would have to say it was the town of Truckee. It was about 20, 30 minutes away from where we were staying, so we would just hop on the bus or a van to get over there. It was a small town. It was focused mostly on rebuilding and revitalization. They're very similar to us in the way that they really love their trails, they really love their outdoors. One of the tours there that I personally did was the river tour, and the river, the Truckee River, is the sole outlet from Lake Tahoe, and it flows all the way through the Sierra, and it flows into Pyramid Lake. The river path, especially for the town, is super important. People use it to get to work, even in the winter time, so they have to plow that path. It's about 10 miles, so it takes a lot of manpower. And recently, they've also had to do some e-bike regulations, which is similar to here. And then some of the other things we talked about in Truckee was transportation and the hospital there, the Truckee Forest Hospital. Truckee's hospitality was incredible, and we were very lucky to meet all of the people there that we did.
Yeah, so was that town most like Park City? Because the others are a little bit bigger. Reno, certainly.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
And what about you, Pete? Anything kind of stand out for you?
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. There were a number of aspects that I think were really resonant and informative with the group. One of the things was just the commonality of the challenges that we face across workforce and affordable housing, transportation, and accommodating growth within the communities. Responsible economic development, balancing those interests with recreation and environmental concerns. So there was a lot that was speaking the same language. And I think that sometimes we can feel we're a little bit isolated or unique in our bubble in having to deal with those challenges. So the connection with other mountain communities that are facing some of those was something that I think all of us felt. Another aspect of it that we really noted was the amount of collaboration we think a lot about the stakeholders that are involved in our decision-making and planning efforts between what the city is doing at the county level, certainly involvement with the state and our neighbors down in Salt Lake. But when we look at what communities like those in North Lake Tahoe or Tahoe City or Truckee need to contend with, you've got multiple states, both California and Nevada. You have multiple counties, Placer, Washoe County, Nevada County, then the various towns themselves that are incorporated or in unincorporated areas, federal land management, a whole host of special districts, as well as the resorts and businesses that are there. So the amount of complexity was really surprising to us. And seeing the amount of collaboration that was really required to get things done, but how they were able to navigate that and still be able to provide input from these various stakeholders, but also be able to arrive at actual decisions.
Yeah, so does Reno serve as Truckee and North Lake Tahoe's base, much like Salt Lake does for the Wasatch Back?
It was something I think all of us definitely noted that parallel. For many of the mountain communities surrounding the lake, Reno is where much of that workforce lives and is forced to commute. That was something that definitely struck us as a parallel. And hearing from the officials in Reno about what they were doing to help both coordinate with, identify the concerns and considerations for those smaller communities, and figure out how they can not just support their own development and growth within Reno, but be able to provide that access, both in terms of the workforce, as well as it's a meaningful source of recreation use as well.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a drive, right, from Truckee to Reno?
It's a drive. It was maybe about an hour or so, so it's not insurmountable. It's a bit longer than what we have, but certainly much of the local workforce does tend to reside in the Reno area. And so some of the things that they've put forth, like really leaning into their vanpool efforts, which yes, we do have some here in Utah, but the way that they had worked to really create more of a public-private partnership in working with some of the large employers in the region to have more, not necessarily dedicated, but focused van transport that can help get those employees from where they reside to where they work.
Okay, as opposed to like what we're seeing with the 106 and 107 to the Salt Lake Valley, large buses that only run a couple times a morning, a couple times at evening. So the vans sound like they're a little bit more efficient.
They can be more efficient. Certainly they did cite what they have seen in the Park City area, what we've done in transportation is something that they aspire to. But they do have certainly challenges that they need to work through where there are limitations on what they can do with the roadways. Many of these communities are more separated than what we have here. So it was very interesting to see some of the solutions that they're working on.
All right, Susan, what kind of stood out for you?
You know, I think the collaboration word really rung in my head a lot. And as Pete was saying, you know, they're dealing with multiple states, counties, et cetera. And, you know, California is a very difficult state to build in from a builder's perspective. It's very expensive. But, you know, by the fallout from that is they've got some really beautiful spaces. They're really focused on the environment, maintaining that blue clarity of the Lake Tahoe, because they say, you know, the environment is the economy and the economy is the environment. If they don't take care of that and be good stewards, then that all goes away. So they've got much more challenges there amongst, 5 million people are within a 4-hour drive of Lake Tahoe. And so they get a lot of day visitors. We're a destination tourism spot. There are a lot of day visitors there. And so the traffic is really significant. And I found it heartening that they're looking to Park City as a good example of our transit system.
Interesting. So are they saying like the bathtub rings like we are with Lake Powell and Lake Tahoe?
You know, I'm not sure about that, but they have a, and I don't remember the word, maybe you do, but there's a clarity test for the water. And that's something that every agency, they're very outcome focused on their strategic plan. And so every single agency, although they might have different, you know, priorities within their own agency, but they all come together for a summit every year and create priorities that maintain the quality of the water, and they're looking at the clarity and how far down you can see, basically, and they're trying to get back to 100 feet, which is what it was originally. I think it got as low as 60 feet, or it is at 60 feet now, and so you can just tell by the fungi that are growing in it and the other pollutants that they're really trying to, everybody's focused on making sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, and we've often heard from these city tours, it's kind of like go steal from the best. Was there anything that it was like, oh my gosh, we got to bring this to Park City? And some of that we see, of course, are our land trust, our kind of hanging flower baskets, anything like that that Park City should bring back?
I think there were a few things that we took note of, both around some of the housing initiatives. They have a lease to locals program, as well as some funded deed restriction programs that they have implemented that they're trying to see. We do have a list of some of the specifics that I think all of us took note of, but really underpinning that was a bias to action. And that was something that I think struck all of us, that these communities, even in some cases with fewer resources than what we have here, are taking some of these ideas and running pilot programs or putting them into effect. And so I think what we really felt was this underpinning of not letting perfection be the enemy of the good. And rather than focusing on really just on planning, it was really around execution. And so I think that was something that we all took away, that if we can have a sense of urgency and really move towards more of that action orientation, we might be able to start gathering the feedback around how some of these initiatives may work in our community.
Okay, I've got just a couple of minutes for this. Class 31 has decided on its class project. Who wants to tell us about it?
I can talk about that. Yes, we have. Very exciting. And with 2 10-hour bus rides under our belt, we got a lot of progress done. We are doing a community connection campaign. We have a kind of a two-pronged approach. I mean, a lot of our conversations in the class were all about trying to help our community feel more included and open up communication. We've had a lot of people who've been more isolated since COVID, and I think that's happened in many communities. So we want to have a two-pronged approach where we can actually provide a physical space, a connection bench, for people to sit and perhaps start a conversation or connect with other community members, and also have some community training on how to start a conversation, how to recognize somebody who might be feeling isolated. We have so many resources here with existing nonprofits, and we've got campaigns going like the Mountain Kind and the We All Belong campaign that we want to partner with and really get the word out for existing resources that our community members can access to help them feel more connected and to really just be able to say hello and you're welcome and include everybody.
Okay. Do you have a location for the bench?
We are hoping to put in 3 to 5 benches around the community, and we're working with Basin Rec and others to try and figure out some great locations for those.
Okay. And no training planned at this point, then?
We have training for the entire class planned, and we hope to expand that to the community at large. We also have kind of an interesting idea to get the community involved in helping with this project since it's for the community, and we'll have more details on that soon.
Okay. Caitlin, you're graduating.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah, congratulations. Real quick, I mean, how what is the benefit, I guess, of somebody your age going through kind of this leadership class, hanging out with people a lot older than you?
I mean, honestly, it's been a really great experience. I've gone into this not really knowing much, especially within like the leadership aspect of Park City. And I think it's been really great, especially being able to learn a lot and then connect with people who I probably wouldn't have met unless it wasn't for this class. And so I'm really grateful for that. I'm grateful for everyone not treating me like I'm 18 years old. And it's just been really awesome. I want to do something in leadership later. I'm going to school for business, and so I'm hoping that I can take away a lot from this class and be able to use it later in life, and then maybe if I come back to Park City after college, that I'll join in leadership somewhere and, yeah, along those lines.
Awesome. All right, well, again, congratulations to you.
Thank you.
You guys, any other parting thoughts?
I just want to offer thanks to Scott Van Hartsfeld and Paige Galvin for their incredible leadership of this program, as well as to all the local officials and leaders, as well as our class members for really doing an exceptional job of representing the community.
Yeah, drinking from a fire hose the last few days. Yeah, it's tough.
It's been a lot, yes, but very rewarding.
Okay,
yes.
Susan, Caitlin, Pete, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie.
You.